It's time for Money for Lunch, where we feed your brain and your business with supersized portions of business and financial news. Now your host, Bert Martinez.
All right, welcome to Money for Lunch. It's been an awesome, awesome week so far. You know, I have to be honest with you, when it comes to our political choices this year, either one I find offensive. At one point, I thought that Mr. Trump was a clear choice, but I don't like him anymore. To be honest with you, I just don't think he's emotionally fit for leadership of this magnitude, right? Now, I think he's gotten better. I think that they've reined him in a little bit, but I just don't think he's the guy. And Mrs. Clinton certainly isn't the gal. Either one I find offensive. So, I don't know. Hit me up. Let me know what you think. Is Trump going to make America great again? Is Hillary going to, whatever her slogan is, keep us together forever, whatever. Anyway, just a weird election cycle. And it's just, I just find it interesting. An historic event could take place here shortly. Hillary may become the first female president. We had an historic beginning. We had like 16, 17, 18 Republicans came on the ballot. I don't know how many Democrats, 5 or 6. So it's been a very unique situation so far. But let's move on from there. I want to give you a little Tuesday trivia, if you will. Going to go to my Instagram account that you can hook up with me there at Instagram. You can just check out The Bert Martinez. And a couple of things. There's only 124 days until Christmas. Just throwing that in there for shock value. That's not the trivia. The trivia is this. 16 out of the 30 corporations in the Dow Jones Industrial Average started during a recession. How about that? 16 out of the 30 corporations in the Dow Jones Industrial Average started during recessionary periods. So, yeah, man. If you have the will and the desire, you can make it happen. And my next guest knows that all too well, Mike Michalowicz. Mike Michalowicz, best-selling author, started first business at the age of 24, moving his young family to the only safe place he could afford, a retirement building. With no experience, no contacts, no savings, he systematically bootstrapped a multi-million dollar business. Then he did it again and again, and he is doing it for other entrepreneurs. Mike is the CEO of Proventus Group, a consulting firm that ignites explosive growth in companies that have plateaued. Mike Michalowicz, welcome to Money for Lunch.
Oh, thank you so much for having me on your show.
It's been a while. I think, when was the last time we had you here? It's been about a year or two?
Yes, as I said, I was thinking 2 years back, but I'm not even sure now. It's been a while.
Well, first of all, I want to talk about this, because one of the things that really added to, to your recognition, your fame, was the best-selling book, The Toilet Paper Entrepreneur. And so why don't you tell everybody a little bit about The Toilet Paper Entrepreneur, because I think this is really kind of that bootstrapping mindset that kind of sets you apart from a lot of people.
Yeah, well, thank you. Yeah, so that came about with the realization that it doesn't take money or it doesn't take contacts or resources to be successful. And actually, just in your introduction, you're talking about how many businesses, how many of the successful Dow, the Dow Jones 100 or 50, started during a recession. it points to the fact that when we don't have resources, we don't have money, the element that has to kick in to subsidize that is innovation. Like, we have to find a way to be innovative and get the same results when we don't have money. We have to find ways to be innovative and think of new strategies when we don't have the contacts that can make it easy for us. So the toilet paper entrepreneur is all about the ultimate in bootstrapping, which is intentionally removing those resources from you, not seeking those out, and forcing yourself to outthink the rest of the industry.
Yes, absolutely. And I think Mark Cuban, he purposely does that. I interviewed Mark a while back, and he talks about he keeps that bootstrapping mindset. And, you know, when he took over Maverick, the Mavericks, you know, he, first of all, one of the first major changes he did is the Mavericks office was in a very, upper scale office building. And he took him out of there and put him in an industrial park because he could save $10,000 a month. And now at the same time, he also bought them a plane that was all customized to fit their massive, you know, their long proportions. So he spends money where he needs to, but he's very much of that bootstrapping mindset where he's looking for, for ideas to be frugal. And just like you said, it doesn't, just because you have the money doesn't mean you have to spend it.
Right. And actually, I think one of my favorite stories around the kind of spending of money and the power of innovation is from the movie Apollo 13. Do you remember that movie, Apollo 13?
Yeah.
So there's a scene where, and this is a true story, these astronauts are circling the moon using its gravitational pull to sling the capsule back to Earth. But there's a problem that happens, and there was many problems on that whole flight, but one of the problems was the oxygen filters started to fail. And these oxygen filters, you know, NASA spent tens of millions of dollars developing systems that could keep fresh oxygen to those astronauts up there. And they radio back to Houston at this pinnacle moment and say, you know, we have 12 hours of oxygen before we're going to die. And in the movie, and this is a truly happened, the engineering team comes together. The lead engineer has a cardboard box of stuff, dumps on the table, and says, these are the parts we have up there. Make an oxygen filter out of it. And it was like duct tape, a tube, some electrical wire. And they made an oxygen filter out of it. And what I think is so fascinating about this is, I don't know, it was a couple $100 of parts that they were able to pull off that capsule. That when NASA was given tens of millions of dollars to find a solution, they did. And it cost tens of millions of dollars. When they were giving to spare parts and a couple $100, that's like Mark Cuban's warehouse situation. You have less, but then you have to make do with what you have. And they made an oxygen filter. So the lesson is this. Many businesses look to pump up their startup by getting investment capital, go to angels, you know, raise from the four Fs, family, friends, and so forth, the founders. And the mentality then is that it will require that money to get started. And we prove ourselves right. The irony is, there's inevitably always a way to get the same results without money. It just requires a lot more thinking. And I think that scene, if you've seen that movie, that scene really should drive that home, that you can do something that would have cost tens of millions for just parts if you're willing to think outside the box, literally in this case.
And I love that. That is a great scene in that movie. It goes to show you absolutely what we can all do. And, you know, this reminds me of, I think it's called Parkinson's Law or something like that, where the work expands to fill the time available. Mm-hmm. Well, money,
that's exactly,
you know, money expands to fill the the task expands to fill the money available. So if you got $10 million, well, heck, you're going to spend $10 million. But if you have, like you said, a box full of spare parts, then you're going to use a box full of spare parts.
Yeah, and that is Parkinson's law to a T. I know the law very well because I studied it. I wrote a dedicated book to money management. It's called Profit First, and it speaks about Parkinson's law. And the theorem of Parkinson's law is that demand increases to meet supply. Now, we think it's the opposite, that supply increases to meet demand. That's economics 101. But behaviorally speaking, it talks of human behavior. They say that as more stuff is available, we consume more. My favorite example is toothpaste. Like tonight, when you're going to bed and you're about to brush your teeth, if you have a full tube of toothpaste, you'll use a good size bead of toothpaste. But when that tube of toothpaste is almost empty, our behavior changes. We use this a small amount. We become very innovative, twisting and turning and squeezing. And that's what Parkinson's law states, that when there's a lot available, we naturally expand our consumption, like NASA did, to use up all that money that they had. When there's a little bit available, we become more frugal, and that's the obvious part. The not obvious part and the more powerful part, though, is the innovation, that twisting and turning of the toothpaste tube, working with that box of scraps for NASA. It's human nature. We will do the same. So intentionally kind of shorthand yourself on the traditional resources of money, contacts, education in the space you are, and it actually will be to your advantage because of Parkinson's law.
I love it. I love it. All right, so let's talk about this. You have a concept that I want you to talk about. It's called Surge. What is this concept of Surge?
Yeah, so Surge is my newest book, and how the concept came about is I've written quite a few books now. A reader came to me and said, I love your books, but, and when you hear but, that's kind of nerve-wracking, but he goes, I love your books, but all the strategies in the world are of no value unless my business is positioned in the right place at the right time. And what I mean by this is, you know, if you and I say, hey, let's go into business together, Bert, and we're going to start a typewriter manufacturing business. This is the wrong time to do that. Typewriters have gone by the wayside. You know, 50 years ago, it might have been a great concept, but today it's no longer a good concept. So the reader was, how do you time the market? How do you make sure that you're coming out with the right product at the right time?
Mm.
And what I found is there is no, you know, there's no guarantee you'll be successful, but you can definitely improve the odds of timing the market. So the Surge concept is how to put your business in the right position at the right time.
I love it. I love it. All right. So let's talk about this, because in the book, you talk about the five stages of Surge. Kind of.
Yes.
Let's run through those five.
Yeah, sure. Sure. So Surge, I started studying surfers, and I love to do parallels or analogies in my books. I think it just makes it more relatable. For me, it's easier to conceptualize. And I found that surfers follow five core steps when they're catching a wave, and it's the exact same steps to catching a movement in the market. So here's what they are. Stage one, and then, by the way, Surge is also an acronym. The S in Surge stands for separate. And what we have to do here is pick out a cove we're going to surf in. Who is the niche what we're going to investigate? If I told you right now, hey, let's go catch a good wave, what's the best wave out in the ocean? That would be a joke, because there's millions, if not billions, of waves happening right now in the ocean. But if I said, hey, let's go down to Surfers Point and, you know, let's check out what the good waves are, now we're looking at a very focused area. We can see the sets rolling in and see if it's good surfing. Well, in business, many people say, hey, what's the new trend? What's going on? What should I be doing? And that's a bad question to ask. The better question is, who is the market that you're interested in serving? And then measuring the changes or the movements happening in that market. So step one in Surge is to separate out the community, the niche, and then investigate and learn about them. The next stage, U, stands for unify. A surfer in the ocean will paddle in front of a wave to catch its speed. They'll actually, you know, not all waves come in the same direction, so you have to catch the angle of the wave also. Well, in the business market, we need to measure what the movement is in the market. What do customers want and why? Why they have this need, and how are they trying to serve it? Then try to unify our solution around it. And there's a great book out there called The Lean Startup. One of the concepts I like in that book is the concept of a minimum viable product. What is the core basic stuff you can provide to the market that you've identified and their new need, and see if they respond to it? Instead of doing a whole solution and no one buys it, do a partial, basically a minimally viable solution, and see if they respond to it. That's the U phase. R stands for rally cry. Any early adopter in any market, and I can share stories about this too, but in any early market, the early adopters are often attacked by the community that surrounds them. The first person that buys the, you know, the first person that bought a car, like an electric car, was laughed at. By, you know, electric car, Bert, just 5-6 years ago was a golf cart. Now, you know, Tesla's doing this, and these. So the first person that buys it is taking on a major risk. And if you remember the press releases from back then, there was tons of press releases about the potential risks and danger of an electric car. You know, lithium batteries packed together with like that, the potential explosiveness, and all this stuff. It's all been mitigated, but when you were the first person to get it, you get attacked by the community around you saying, this is crazy, don't do this. So you have to protect your early adopters. And you do that through what's called a rally cry. What is the greater, almost transcending purpose of your offering? So when people are getting attacked for buying an electric car and taking on these risks, that Tesla buyer could defend themselves by saying, but yeah, I'm serving our planet. I'm going green. Or if they were speaking to maybe the performance community saying, listen, I'm going green and my car can outrace a Corvette or something. So they had a way to defend themselves, and that's what's called the rally cry. As you get these early adopters consuming your offering, how are you going to protect them from the inevitable attack of the people that surround them? And two more stages. G stands for gather. If you're up on a wave surfing, you actually look for what's called the pocket. It's the energy source of the wave, and you'll ride, you'll carve back and forth looking for those elements of the wave. The analogy for business is once you're up on the wave and you have momentum, right? You're serving these early adopters. You got a solution. More people are coming to you. It's a bizarre time because you are – intentionally one of the early providers to the market. You're offering something that no one else has yet or as early to the market as possible, that consumers will flock to you. The analogy I like to use here just to drive this home is like if you and I were walking through the desert and dying of thirst and someone was selling water, we will flock to that person. Now that water could be inferior water. It could be muddy. It could be sandy. It could be bacteria-ridden. But the risk of not drinking – So inferior water works for a period of time until the day that a person shows up with clean bottled water. All the customers will jump to that new offering. But there's a danger here. If you're the guy offering muddy water, you think you're doing well because people are coming to you. Like, clearly, they like muddy water. People that are just keep coming to me. But no, they're coming to you because they're dying of thirst. So once you start getting movement in a market, when you're the early provider, many times your solution actually isn't perfect. It's the exclusive solution, and that's why you're getting business. But when a competitor sets in or alternative set in, you're in real trouble. So you have to constantly evaluate your early consumers and find out what don't you have right yet? What don't they like about your product? Even though they're buying it, what don't they like and improve it? And then the final phase is expansion, and it has to be the final step. Once you mastered your niches, once you really have traction in a niche and you're offering an early introduction service or offering or product for community, once you're gathering knowledge from them and improving the product, then and only then you start looking for clone niches. What other categories exist just like this? If you were making electric cars, you know, electric trucks. What about, you know, the delivery vehicles and stuff like that? Maybe some other kind of electrical vehicles, electric airplanes one day. Why not? Like, you know, those might be equivalent clone niches. One of my favorite stories, and I'll kind of wrap up on this, one of my favorite stories is UGG. I was talking with Brian Smith, the founder of UGG, and said, you know, you're in every closet in America as long as there's a teenage girl there. How did you get to such a large market? He said, no. And he followed the surge process. Actually, I talk about him extensively in the book Surge. He followed the surge process. He first picked a niche, which was surfers, in this case, ironically. And he ultimately found that the problem he was solving was cold feet, cold wet feet. And he said, what other markets exist that are just like the surfer market? Athletes who get cold wet feet. And he said, well, hockey players, right? You come in after playing on the ice, off of freezing ice, but you're sweaty, cold wet feet, skiers, hunters. And he started selling to those markets using the exact same mechanisms he mastered on surfers. And then only ultimately, once he had, I think it was $100 million in revenue, did they go for the ultimate expansion move and went after the teenage girl, you know, fashion market. But they expanded by replicating and cloning niches.
I love it. Surge. And so the book is called Surge, or what's the complete title of the book?
That's the complete title of the book. It's called Surge. And the subtitle is that you can time the marketplace, ride the wave of consumer demand, just like we were talking about, and become the industry's big kahuna. And listen, it's kind of the goal is to be, of course, a catchy title. But the reality is when you follow this method, you do become the industry's big kahuna in the consumer's mind because you're offering something new, a little bit ahead of the game, and you're focusing on such a small category that you're seen as the authority.
Yeah, no, I love it. And the book, when is the book coming out?
It was just released recently. It came out a month ago. So we're doing this in August. It came out in July. Yeah.
Okay, great. So available on Amazon and wherever good books are sold.
Yep.
I love it. The book is called Surge, the best-selling author, Mike Michalowicz. And Mike, we're out of time, but I'd love to bring you back and talk more about Surge and some of the current Surge opportunities that you're seeing out there. Always good to have you on the show, my friend.
Bert, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
All righty. Good stuff there from Mike Michalowicz, best-selling author. He's got several books. So The Toilet Paper Entrepreneur was his first. Then he came out with the pumpkin plan that was compared to the Eve myth. They called it the next E myth. And then now he's got the book Surge. So he's got three books, maybe four. Mike Michalowicz, always good. You can find him on Google, of course. Just Google his name. Just type in Pumpkin Plan or the book Surge, and you'll get a hold of him and host of the other stuff that he's doing. All right, we're going to take a quick commercial break, and then we'll be back.
Did you bring the camera phone?
I did.
Do you want to go first?
I've been waiting for this all day.
Okay, this is Fro and Stacy.
Introducing Chase Quick Deposit. Just photograph the front and back of your check using the Chase Mobile app on your iPhone and hit send.
It went through?
So cool.
This is so cool.
You want to try it?
Yeah.
Okay.
All right, it was nice.
Make a deposit from anywhere, anytime with your iPhone.
To Mr. and Mrs. Walker, why would they send my parents a check?
Chase what matters.
Welcome back to Geico Radio. It's savings on the radio.
Caller Steve. Go right ahead.
Yeah, I just got a free rate quote on geico.com. Saved a ton, and it only took me 5 minutes and 12 seconds. I was wondering, is that some sort of record?
That's a good question. Let's have a look.
Not quite. Someone's got you beat by 8 seconds.
Still, I mean, that's quite fast.
Well, what if I told you I only use one hand?
Geico. 15 minutes could save you 15% or more on car insurance.
Tune in Monday through Friday here on Money for Lunch. And check out our website at moneyforlunch.com.
All right. We are back. My next guest, Stephen Goldstein. Stephen Goldstein is the author of the new book, Why Are There Snowblowers in Miami? What an interesting question. I mean, it's something that we all talk about. Why are there snowblowers in Miami? Available in September. He has over 35 years experience working as an operating executive in both global Fortune 500 corporations, including as chairman and CEO of American Express Bank, mid-sized companies, as well as advising private equity firms with their portfolio companies. Stephen Goldstein, welcome to Money for Lunch.
Thanks, Bert. It's a pleasure to be on your program.
Well, you know what? I'm excited to have you here, and I cannot wait to discuss this book. And I got to start off by asking you, why this unusual title? Because I've been to Miami. I don't think I've ever seen a snowblower, and I'm sure that they have them there, but maybe they're tucked away. So why this title?
Well, this title actually comes from a story, a real story. About 20 years ago, I was the president of the Sears credit card business based in Chicago. And one February, I had to go to Miami to give a speech to the National Retail Federation. So I was very happy to leave a terribly cold winter in Chicago and head to an 85-degree Miami. And whenever I traveled, I wanted to visit our stores and all of our facilities to keep in touch with our customers and our employees and see what's going on. So I went into a local Sears store in Miami, and the door I happened to go into was the Lawn and Garden Center. And, you know, I saw what you'd expect to see: lawnmowers, patio furniture, barbecue grills, rakes and shovels, and all of that sort of outdoor stuff. And then in the corner of my eye, or in the corner of the floor, I see what looked like four snowblowers. And, you know, I thought I was maybe a little tired or I was hallucinating, and I just sort of went over there, and sure enough, there were four snowblowers. And so there was a salesman there, and I asked him, I identified myself, and I said to him, "Pete, why are there snowblowers in Miami?" And he said, "Oh, you don't know half of the story." I said, "I don't know anything." And basically he told me this story that they would get these snowblowers in September, and they'd put them on the floor, and then in April they would pack them up in boxes and send them back to the distribution center. And I said, "Well, how long has this been going on?" And he said, "Well, I've been here 30 years. It's been going on as long as I've been here." And then I said to him, "So what do you do about it?" He says, "Well, my boss calls headquarters and the store manager calls headquarters." "And what do they say?" He says, "Well, they tell them it's part of the national allocation." And I said, "Well, do you know what that means?" And he says, "Absolutely not." So I said, "Okay, I've got one, Pete, but I only have one more question to ask you. Have you ever sold one?" And he said, "Yeah, a few years ago, I sold one to a couple who was going to visit their kids in Minneapolis, and they put it in the minivan and drove up from Miami to Minneapolis to give it to them for a Christmas gift." So I leave Pete, and I get in a taxi, and I go over and give my speech, and I couldn't get this visual out of my mind. And the next day, I had to go back to Chicago for our weekly leadership meeting. And even though we didn't call at the time, it was like the polar vortex storms. You know, it was a terrible and over most of the country. And the topic of this meeting was the storm and how it was affecting our supply chain. And, you know, not surprisingly, we were out of snowblowers. And they were all stuck in his warehouse somewhere in North Dakota or something. And so everybody's sort of complaining about that. And then I reach into my pocket and pull out this guy's business card. And I said, "Look, I know where there are four. Call this guy. You can have four." And they all start laughing, you know, like, "This is hysterical." And I said, "Well, why are you laughing? This is not funny." And, you know, like most things in corporate America, the meeting came to an end. No decision was made. And I go back to my office, and I was really furious. And I told my assistant to stop what she's doing. And, you know, this is sort of pre-internet. And I said, "I want you to find out in the history of recorded weather how many times it snowed in Miami. And don't do anything else until you get that answer." And so, you know, I said, "Call NASA, call NUMA, call the, you know, the weather service, whatever." She comes back in 45 minutes and she said, "Okay, I've got the answer. It snowed one time, 7 years ago, a third of an inch." And, you know, so, you know, you don't know whether to laugh or cry. And I realized that that story was sort of a metaphor for corporate dysfunction. And, you know, I started to think about all the things that I had observed prior to that happening in my working life. And fast forward, a few years ago, I decided to write a book. And as I was thinking what to write about, I just thought about this snowblower story. And I thought about everything that happened since that time, some 20 years ago. And I realized that there was a real serious problem out there, you know, relating to lack of engagement. And so I decided to write the book. And when I thought about what the title should be, I started to go down the conventional route of what, you know, business books would look like. But I couldn't get this title out of my brain. And my agent thought it was terrible. And I fought with him. And finally, you know, I prevailed. And that's the title. So I love the title. And everybody who has seen it so far, they start laughing. I mean, it's like, we got to find out what's going on in this book.
Sure. Well, first of all, that is, to me, part of a successful book, is you have to have a title that engages people. And you and I have probably read so many typical
business books, you know, the how to do this, the, you know, right. the, what do you call it, leader this, and stuff like that, that when you say, you know, why are there snowblowers in Miami, it engages the mind, because it's an oxymoron. There really should not be any snowblowers in Miami. And the
exactly.
fact that you found four of them shows you a lot of dysfunction, right? I mean, you're
right.
telling me that for 30 years, these guys would get these snowblowers, and then at the end of the season, they'd pack them up, send them back. Yeah, that I think is a great metaphor for the human condition, and a lot it's applicable to the government, it's applicable to corporations, and it's applicable to our human frailties.
Absolutely. And what I found as in the course of writing the book, I interviewed 15 CEOs because I wanted to. The book is filled with stories because I'm a firm believer that, as you said, most of the business books are pretty dry. And I figured that I wanted to write the kind of book I would like to read. And so
right.
I think to be engaged, people remember things more when they remember stories. And if the story captivates them, they're more likely to remember the substance of what the story's about. So I've got tons of stories, but I didn't want the book to be about me. So I went and I talked about, as I mentioned, to 15 CEOs. And what was really funny about that is, you know, I would tell them the snowblower story because I wanted to put them in a frame of mind where they could relate to it. And I got the same reaction 15 times. I wish I had a video. First, they would laugh, just like you did. And then they
right.
would say, oh, I've got 20 snowblower stories, or I've got 15 snowblower stories. And it became either a noun or a verb to describe, you know, as you described, a condition or a series of circumstances that really are inexplicable, you know, and which everyone
right.
takes for granted and accepts. It seemed to be a good way to dive into the subject of engagement and transformation.
No, absolutely. Yeah. You know, this is going to be a thing. People are going to start asking people, so what's your snowblower story? It's going to become a thing. It's going to be a lexicon. Is that what it's right?
Yeah.
A lexicon or a word in America, in the business lexicon there. Okay. So let me ask you this, because this is really a lot about engagement here. So why do you feel there is such a lack of engagement by the leaders and the C-suite?
So let me tell you one fact, and then I'll answer your question. So Gallup organization has been running a survey. They run lots of surveys, but one survey they do is about employee engagement. And the most recent study that they did shows that 70% of employees, and this is at all levels, are disengaged. And of that 70%, 20% of the 70%, or 20% of the total, are actively disengaged. Now, that as bad as that is, the worst part about it is it's basically been flat since the survey started in 2000. So this is not something that is illusory. This is very real and palpable. And, you know, as I started to think about it, I don't think leaders wake up in the morning and say, okay, when I go to work today, I want to be disengaged.
Right, right.
Right? You know, I don't think people do that. I'm highly confident they don't do that. But nevertheless, they are not engaged. And I think there's a lot of reasons to explain it. One is, they're on a treadmill. They're just running from meeting to meeting. They're sort of, their day is taking over their lives, and they don't really actively think about things. You know, they're more mechanical, and I think that they're not sure at some level that there's value in being engaged. That they don't realize that if they got out of their office and talked to employees and customers, they might actually learn something that would be beneficial to their business. I think it's more interesting to focus on strategic issues, to launch new products, to open new markets, to do M&A and, you know, make acquisitions, to do some financial engineering, all things that, you know, theoretically and in many cases do create shareholder value, but they're things that are sort of dissociated from the basic day-to-day business. You know, back in the day when, you know, R.H. Macy opened the first Macy's store, his office was in the store. And to get to his office, he had to go up the escalator and walk all the floors and touch the sweaters and talk to people and see customers. And they were, those guys back then, they knew exactly what was going on in the store.
Right.
Of course, when you have 1,000 stores, that's not so easy. But I think the problem is that people don't do it at all. You know, I've seen many times when a leader goes to visit an office, you know, it's scheduled 4 months in advance. They go with an entourage, everything's scripted. And so, you know, they really don't see the real world. I used to live in London, and the joke there was the Queen thinks everything smells like fresh paint because whenever she visited someplace, they would paint it, you know, before she went in, so it looked clean. And so every time she went in there, it smelled like fresh paint. And they said, well, do you think she knows that there's another smell besides fresh paint? It's sort of the same thing. You know, it became so mechanical and so contrived that you lose the essence of really what's going on.
Yeah. And so I guess the question is, so actually I have two questions. So first of all, what is your definition of an engaged leadership? What does that look like to you?
I think an engaged leader really behaves in a couple of ways. One is you are intimately involved in the business, not by looking at reports, but rolling up your sleeves and getting your hands dirty. You're ultra aware of what's going on. You take an outside-in view of the organization, which is not you know, jargon. It means you really have to see your business from the outside, not the way you see it from inside. It means being hyper inquisitive. I have this. I call it the why question. I keep asking why. Why do we do it this way? Why do we charge for this service? Why do we keep selling this product if no one's buying it? Why do we open a store if nobody comes in? Why do we have too many people in the store? Why do we have people in a call center that have terminals that are the old base terminals? You remember those terminals that fill up the whole desk? These screens have been in for like 15 years. They have those. They're on chairs with three legs, and their headsets have duct tape on them, and they're on a phone with a customer 8 hours a day trying to do a good job. And I mean, you walk into the place, and it looks like the Flintstones, and you say, how can you expect someone to do a good job in that context? And the only answer to that is they don't go visit those places, because if they did, you would hope they'd be appalled by what they see and address it. Engaged means really understanding and getting to know your employees, not to be their friend, but to really understand what's going on. If you think about, take a store like The Gap. Between the CEO of The Gap and a part-time clerk in a store, there's probably between 18 to 20 levels of management. And the interesting thing is the only person who's selling a T-shirt to a customer is that part-time person who's making $9 an hour with no benefits. And so so that's the one who's paying the rent. That's the one who's paying the CEO's salary. That's the one who's doing everything. And yet no one really talks to this person to find out what's going on. I was in a store a couple of months ago waiting online to pay for something. It wasn't The Gap. I won't say the name of the store. But this woman in front of me wanted to return a sweater for a different size. And so she goes up to the counter, and the sales woman says, what can I help you? And she said, well, I'd like to change this from a medium to a large. And the person says, well, you bought this online, you need to return it online. And she said, well, I want to return it in the store. And by the way, I see there's one over there. I just want to switch it. The same price, everything's the same. She said, well, madam, you can't do that. If you bought it online, you have to return it online. And they got into this whole argument. And finally, she gave up and she said, fine, I will do that, and I will never buy something from your store again. So then it was my turn to pay for something. And I could see that the face of the sales clerk, she was very disturbed. She knew that what she did didn't make any sense. But she was following what she was told to do. And,
sure.
Right? And so she what else could she do? And so I thought to myself, here's what probably happened. You have an online business within the company and you have a retail business in the company. They both have two presidents. They both have two P&Ls. They may have their own supply chains. You know, they may have their own pricing structure. They may have their own distribution channels. And they don't talk to each other. So that's how that happens. Now, here's
and I'm going to take it one step further. So not only do they not talk to each other, they're in competition with each other.
Yes, exactly. Very good point. So here's the question that I don't know the answer to. If the CEO of that company spent an hour in the store and observed what I observed, which took 5 minutes, but let's say he stood there or she stood there for an hour and observed what went on, You would hope that they went back to headquarters, they would describe this and say to their team, this is insanity. I want a plan to fix this ASAP, right?
Yes.
And that's not how we roll. That's not how we do our business. That's not how we serve our customers. Now, if the guy didn't say that, then you have a different problem. He's the wrong CEO. But you don't find this out reading a report. You know, you don't find this out by looking at the financials. And that's what I mean by engagement. It really means immersing yourself in the business.
Absolutely. Listen, we are out of time, Stephen, but I'd love to bring you back and talk more about this because this is a subject matter that we could spend literally hours on. To me, it's so amazing, and there's so much ground that we didn't get to cover in our talk together. So I'd love to bring it back, talk more about why are there snowblowers in Miami. You can find the book online, Why Are There Snowblowers in Miami? The author is Stephen Goldstein. Stephen, thank you so much for stopping by.
Thank you, Bert.
Good stuff there from Stephen Goldstein, and this guy knows what he's talking about. The book, again, Why Are There Snowblowers in Miami. Why are there snowblowers in Miami? Check it out. You can tell that it's just going to be a really engaging read. It's going to be a lot of fun, and you'll probably walk away a better leader. We're going to take a quick commercial break. Oh, no, we're not. We're just going to go straight to Ed. Oh, excellent, excellent, excellent. So my next guest, Ed Brudeau. Brudeau, I think this is the second or third or fourth time he's the king of negotiators. He travels the world teaching people how to negotiate. And if you can follow him on Facebook, you can see his travels. Brudeau is a negotiating expert, political commentator, and the author of six books. His latest book, In Lies We Trust, How Politicians and the Media Are Deceiving the American Public. Ed Brudeau, welcome back to Money for Lunch.
Hi, Bert.
It's good to have you back.
Good to be back.
See, I've been watching you on Facebook, and you were like all over the Orient there for a while.
Yeah, I just got back from Kenya. I was in Africa.
Oh, that's right. I saw that too. That's right. You guys went to Kenya as well. I saw that, and I love the pictures with the tribe that you took with there in Kenya. I thought that was excellent. I love that stuff.
The Samburu, they were fantastic. Yeah. Some great pictures.
And food? Good food?
The food was excellent where I stayed. We stayed at this beautiful place up on Mount Kenya. The food was excellent.
All right, so let's talk about your latest book, In Lies We Trust, How Politicians and the Media Are Deceiving the American Public. First of all, why write the book? What inspired you to write this book?
I wrote this book because we have a presidential election coming up, and people want to vote in this election, but they have been lied to so consistently by politicians and the media that it's almost impossible for people to make a rational decision about who to vote for without understanding the truth about the issues. So in this book, I blow the whistle, and I tell the truth, and I point out where we've been lied to in just enormous ways. Shall I give you a couple of controversial examples?
Yes. Yes, you can.
Let me go straight to the real controversial parts of my book. First of all, my conclusion is that this whole global warming thing is a hoax. Now, I could be arrested, Bert, for saying that. There's a bill right now in front of the California legislature that would make it a crime for me to say what I just said, to say that global warming is a hoax. They want to criminalize
it. Really?
They want to kill freedom of speech over this issue. Now, the joke is that there is an overwhelming preponderance of evidence that global warming does not exist. Yet when you hear the government, you hear Obama and the media talk about global warming, you think it's absolutely the word they use is incontrovertible. Well, let me tell you something, Bert. I started out, before I wrote this book, when I started writing the book, I was like most people. I didn't know that much about global warming. I wasn't sure about it. So I started doing research, and I did a lot of research. And the more research I did, the more I came to the conclusion that the whole thing is a crock. There is so much preponderance. There were 31,000 scientists have signed a petition saying that global warming is a hoax. And where did it come from? And Al Gore made a movie about it in which he made these ridiculous predictions. He predicted in 2004 that if we don't take action to stop global warming, by January of 2016, he said, the world was going to come to an end. Now, he actually said
that. I think the documentary is called An Inconvenient Truth, right?
Yeah, something like that, yeah. And he made all these.
Yeah.
There were a whole bunch of predictions, all of which have turned out to be false, especially that one. I mean, I'm sure you agree with me. It's a good thing the world didn't come to an end, or we wouldn't be having this conversation right now.
That's right. That's right. You know what? Here's the deal. Here are my thoughts on global warming. Okay. First of all, I do not believe that it is as bad as our government and some of these people are saying it is. Now, as a population, as people who are living on this planet, are we affecting the planet? Yes, of course we are. You know, we're adding pollution, we're adding waste. So we are, having
an impact on the planet.
An impact on the planet. Is it going to end January 16th? No, it's not. And it's not going to end January 17th. And the funny thing about global warming, the thing that really frustrates the most is that no matter what the weather is, it's because of global warming. What's happening in Louisiana, it's global warming. What's happening in Arizona is global warming. What's happening in whatever part of the country, like the drought that California or in India, that's global warming too. So, you know, it's to me, what a great position to put yourself in, that no matter what the answer is, no matter what the situation, it's because of global warming.
Yeah, well, I'd like to make two points, Bert. Number one, we have to distinguish between global warming and pollution. And when you say that we're impacting the planet, yeah, there's pollution is a problem. But that's to say that there's pollution is not the same thing as to say that it is global warming. You see what I'm saying?
I agree with you. Yeah,
and
that's a
very important point that is being overlooked, and we're being hoodwinked because of that. Secondly, there's this thing called the hockey stick theory of global warming, and they show a graph where the graph in the last 100 years is a lot of warming. Well, that's been refuted by scientists who've shown that 500 years ago it was even hotter than it is now. In other words, it's a normal process on the planet. The planet gets cold, it gets warm. There's an ice age, and it warms up. It's normal. It's not something that is caused by human carbon emissions, as they're all suggesting. So the whole thing is, and the other thing, when they say that 90, there's a figure, 97% of scientists agree with global warming. That's what the media puts out. Well, that's been totally refuted. When you look at this 31,000 scientists who said that it's nonsense. So we're being fed a lot of lies, lies by the politicians, lies by the media, and the danger is that we'll wind up spending trillions of dollars. We'll kill our economy, because if we do what they want, it's going to ruin our economy. And here we are throwing trillions of dollars away for something that doesn't exist. That's madness.
Right, right. Well, and I think that we've seen this over and over and over again, right? The government steps in, they do this fear-based marketing, and they start a new department. They start a new system of regulations, and before you know it, there is oversight, and there's corruption, and there's, you know, there are billionaires being
made. Well, the whole thing was started by the UN. You know, this whole thing was started by the UN back in 1972, and the UN has its own agenda. They have their own political agenda, which is what the whole thing is really about. It's about a political agenda that these people want to gain control. They want to push for a one-world government where they're in charge. It's very complicated politically. But the point that I make in my book is that the reality is that we don't have to worry about global warming because the whole thing is a hoax, and we're being lied to. Being lied to.
All right.
Now, another big thing that I talk about in my book that we're being lied to is this whole business of Islamic terrorism. We have a president who refuses to use the term Islamic terrorism. Now, that frightens the hell out of me, because if you can't define the enemy and talk about who the enemy is, you're dead. And what's happening is we are pretending that it doesn't exist, when in point of fact, the Islamic world is at war with the West. And Islam, in my opinion, is a totalitarian political ideology that is masquerading as a religion. And they are anti-women. They want to mutilate and subjugate women. They want to throw gay people off the roof and stone gay people. They want to murder Jews and Christians and Hindus and anyone who doesn't agree with their ideology. And that is all, by the way, it's all in the Quran. It's not something, I'm not making this up, it's right there. Everybody, they're not hiding it. It is the ideology of Islam. Now, people say, well, what about all the millions of Muslims who don't believe that? Well, here's what I think. I think there are a lot of Muslims who call themselves Muslims, but they don't really uphold the doctrine of the religion. They're Muslims for social and ethnic reasons, just as there are many Jews and Christians who don't, they don't go to church, they don't go to synagogue, but they don't, but they follow their religion because they like to go to the socials. There's a social aspect of it. There's an ethnic aspect
right,
of it.
They were raised in that culture, so they identify with it. But wait a minute, I want to back up a little bit. Putting the president's vocabulary aside, are you saying that we are not taking terrorism seriously?
Yes. Yes,
what
I absolutely
like
am. Listen to what the president says. Listen to what the attorney general wants to prosecute anyone who is guilty of anti-Muslim anti-Muslim rhetoric, she calls it. Again, another attempt to destroy free speech. It's the government is acting pissed, and we are at terrible risk because we are not responding to a threat, and the threat is that Islam is at war with the West.
Yes, and you know what? Look. Here's the deal. First of all, I agree with you that these people are against women. They look at women as objects, and you know they abuse women, they abuse children, they would kill anybody that stands in their way or has a different opinion. I think that we've seen enough of this. We've seen this constantly. Now, do you think that if
either Mr. Trump or Mrs. Clinton get into office that any of this would change?
Yes, I do. Well, just listen to what they're saying. Trump is the only one who's taking this thing by the horns, who's saying, look, we have a problem. There is a problem that is inherent in Islam. And if we're going to have people coming from that part of the world into our country, we have to vet them and find out, you know, where they're at. Are they willing to assimilate and become assimilated into our culture? Or are they violently opposed to our culture, and do they want to destroy our culture? Look what's happening in Europe. That's what's happening in Europe. They're trying to destroy the Western cultures. So we have Trump is the one who is bringing attention to that. And Hillary.
And I want to step in. I want to step in here a second and point this out. I want, if somebody doubts what Ed is saying, I want you. You don't have to take our word for it. Don't take Ed's word for it. Just do your own research. Don't sit there and live in denial. Do your own research. See what's happening in Europe. See the headlines in Europe. See what is being reported in Europe, and you can see how a few people, all of a sudden, go from just a few people to literally thousands of Muslims who attack the culture, the community. They're taking over, and something does need to be, you know.
There's a name for this, Bert. It's called civilizational jihad. It's a doctrine in Islam where they want to take over other cultures, and jihad is what they call it. And do you know that the president has told the government that we cannot use the word jihad? The Department of Homeland Security is not allowed to use the word jihad. They're not allowed to use the word Sharia. They're not allowed to say Islamic terrorism. I mean, this is absolutely.
Now, when you say that, what research led you to that? Where did you find that information?
It's been in the papers. It's in the papers. Look it up. Anybody can look it up. By the way, you just said something I want to clarify. In my book, I'm not telling people what to think. I want people. The point of my book is I want people to be able to make up their own minds based on facts. So what I'm giving them in my book are the facts about the main issues of the day, so that they can make up their own minds. I believe that people have to use critical thinking, and they're not. We're just gullible. We believe all this crap that's put out there. People have to learn to make up their own minds, as you say, do their own research. And my book is a tool to help people, because I've done the research, and you can check it out. If anybody reading my book, is going to come away with a much better understanding of the realities of life today, as opposed to the nonsense that's being put out there by the newspapers and by television and by the government.
Yeah. It is interesting. And you know what? The book again is where is it at? In Lies We Trust, How Politicians and the Media Are Deceiving the American Public. And you know what? Here's the deal. A lot of people do not know this, and I know, Ed, that you probably do know this. But look, the media, they go with the flow. They go with the, just like everybody else. The road of least resistance. And so when the government sends the media some information, they'll just spit it out. They don't do their own research. Many times we've seen all of the different organizations, Fox News, CBS, NBC, ABC, all of them have been caught not doing their own research and have been busted for just, you know, spitting out whatever's given to them. And this is a problem, because most of us will look at the media and we think that they're being, objective, and they're not.
Well, I debunk that, and Lies We Trust debunks that, and I explain in detail how the media distort the news, and I show the techniques that they use, and I show why they do it, and it's really quite insidious. It's a terrible problem that we have. It used to be that, for example, the New York Times, when I was a kid, you could trust the New York Times for the news. And today, I never know if what I read in the Times is real or it's something that they made up. It's pathetic.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's amazing. Ed, we're out of time. I'd love to bring you back and talk more about this. because I'd like to bring it back and talk about specifically how the media is deceiving the American public. The book, again, is In Lies We Trust, How Politicians and the Media Are Deceiving the American Public by Ed Brudeau, and it's available on Amazon or wherever good books are sold. And, Ed, always good to have you on the show, my friend.
Thank you, Bert.
Good stuff there. And, again, I want you guys to go out there and get the book In Lies We Trust. And it's just something that everybody needs to be aware of. And again, do your own research, make your own decision. But as Ed said, this is just a catalyst. It's a tool, and you can get it, and you can see his research. And the last name is Brodow, 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 In Lies We Trust. And we're going to have Ed back to talk about the other side of the coin, which is the media. Amy, if you'll arrange that with Ed, that'll be great. Guys, we are responsible for our actions. And what I mean by that is we're responsible for making a decision based on our own research, based on our decisions, based on our understanding of what's happening, and not just responding or reacting to what somebody else has told us. Remember, you were created to succeed.
Tune in Monday through Friday here on Money for Lunch, and check out our website at moneyforlunch.com.